cow hoof went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloudy draw.
This is Dan Kinler, volunteer reader for Some Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we will be reading from the book, The Humor of the American Cowboy, by Stan Hoig, illustrated by Nick Eggenhofer. And this is a bison book published by the University of Nebraska Press in Lincoln in 1958. I'd be remiss if I didn't offer a tip of the hat to Murray Everson, our Tucson station manager, for putting me onto this book. And I also remind you that some of our stories are edited slightly for recording. Let's start with the preface that explains a little bit about the book. This book is a direct result of the admiration I hold for the American cowboy. Having been born and raised in a cattle-raising area of the Southwest, I've known many cowboys and cattlemen. I once spent one of my more enjoyable autumns in a little shack with a rheumatism stove cowpoke named Bill, whose major misery in life was bedbugs. As far as I know, Bill never took any action against them, except to complain once in a while. I'm especially grateful to those cowhands who brave the deserts of rhetoric to report on their part of cowboy life. In collecting this material on the American cowboy and his humor, I have read scores of books written by cowboys who wanted to give a true account of cowboy life as it was in the old days. While I've tried to point out a few of the relevant facts concerning the cowboy's personality, my aim has largely been to pass on the cowboy's humor for the entertainment and enlightenment of the uninitiated. Most of these jokes and stories are old mossy backs and have been around aplenty. But for those not overly familiar with the Old West, this humor should be just as fresh as it was when a man could ride 100 miles and never see a fence. The biggest part of the gather has been rounded up from the back brush of libraries. Some are a little woolly, but I'm sure that whoever sinks his teeth into this beef will agree that it's salty. I'm deeply obligated to Mr. Brent Aschebrenner, who offered invaluable roundup assistance, to Dr. Cecil B. Williams of Oklahoma State University, without whose friendly interest and chuckwagon advice these longhorns might never have made a herd, and to my wife Pat, who took on the chore of loading these critters. I'm grateful also to Dr. E. E. Dale and to Ramon F. Adams for their kind encouragement. I also wish to thank American Mercury magazine for permission to reprint The Windy West, which appeared in their October 1953 issue, and Railroad magazine for permission to reprint Cowboy vs. Railroader, which appeared in their December 1953 issue. And that was the preface. The first story we will read is entitled Laugh Kills Lonesome, and our author starts with a quote from Philip Ashton Rollins. To understand ranch lingo, all you have to do is to know in advance what the other feller means, and then pay no attention to what he says. The old Wild West is gone. The sands of time drift thicker and thicker over the days of the open range, of great cattle herds, of reckless, free-riding men on horseback. The physical existence of the old West is recalled only by a deserted trail town, a crumbling adobe wall, a stretch of trampled ground that was once a boulevard of cattle traffic. Only a scant few of the old cowboy breed remain, gnarled old-timers whose memories are filled with lore of the past. To these remnants of the cowboy legion, the ghosts of yesterday beckon as they gallop with the sweeping prairie winds. More than a half a century has passed, and remember this was written in 1958, since the cowboy empire began its decline. It left behind no architectural monuments. The trees of science and religion bore no fruit for posterity. Even the social development of the West was made largely in spite of the cattle industry. Yet the cowboy era had a greatness about it, a greatness of spirit that was as much a part of the cowboy as the cowboy was a part of his times. It was a spirit of strong men in a free world, based on a combination of physical and psychological stamina. Out of it grew an understanding of human nature and a realistic attitude toward life that was expressed in rich, fertile humor. Will Rogers, whose wit and sagebrush philosophy caught the fancy of the world, was a product of the cowboy's humor. Though Rogers' scope of thought ranged far wider than did that of the ordinary cowpoke, his humor has roots that sink deep into the cow country. But this real glory that was the cowboy's appears destined for oblivion. The chief consequence of the cowboy's brief hour upon the stage has been to furnish a character type for modern entertainment media. The romance and adventure attached to his person offer excellent opportunities for commercialization. In the many billions of words that have been written about the cowboy, scant attention has been paid to his amazing capacity for humor. As a result, the true image of the cowboy rides a lonely trail today, its saddle mates few, the ambushers many. Historical reality is sinking into a quagmire of rodeo costumes, hillbilly singers, and television and movie heroes. Even the folklorists have become so fascinated with the cowboy that they've ordained a folk hero for him. When Pecos Bill appeared in a 1923 Century Magazine article, he was accepted, evidently without question, as a rival for Paul Bunyan, Feebold Feeboldson, and folk heroes of other areas. Since then, the students of Western folklore have continued to attribute the tall tales of the range to the Pecos Bill myth. In 1919, 4 years prior to the Century article, John A. Lomax published his Songs of the Cowboy Trail and Cow Camp. It contains a reading entitled The Legend of Bountiful Bill. This verse appears to be at least one bona fide ancestor of the Pecos Bill yarns. At a roundup on the Gila, one sweet morning long ago, 10 of us was throwed quite freely by a hoss from Idaho. And we loud he'd go a-beggin' for a man to break his pride, till, a-hitchin' up one leggin', boastful Bill cut loose and cried, "I'm an ornery proposition for to hurt. I fulfill my earthly mission with a quirt. I can ride the highest liver 'twixt the Gulf and Powder River, and I'll break this thing as easy as I'd flirt." So Bill climbed the northern fury, and they mangled up the air, till a native of Missouri would have owned the brag was fair. Though the plunges kept him reeling, and the wind had flapped his shirt, loud above the hosses squealing, we could hear our friend assert, "I'm the one to take such rockin' as a joke. Someone hand me up the makin' of a smoke. If you think my fame needs brightenin', why, I'll rope a streak of lightnin' and spur it up and quirt it till it's broke." Then one caper of repulsion broke that hoss's back in two. Cinches snapped in the convulsion, skyward man and saddle flew. Up they mounted, never flaggin', and we watched them through our tears, while this last thin bit of braggin' came a-floatin' to our ears. If you ever watch my habits very close, you'd know how I broke such rabbits by the gross. I have kept my talent hidin', I'm too good for earthly ridin', so I'm off to bust the lightnin'. Adios. Years have passed since that ascension. Boastful Bill ain't never lit, so we reckon he's a wrenchin' some celestial outlaw's bit. When the night wind flaps our slickers, and the rain is cold and stout, and the lightning flares and flickers, we can sometimes hear him shout, "I'm a ridin' son of thunder of the sky. I'm a bronco twistin' wonder on the fly. Hey, you earthlings, shut your winders. We're a-rippin' clouds to flinders. If this blue-eyed darlin' kicks at you, you die." Stardust on his chaps and saddle, scornful still of jar and jolt, he'll come back sometime a-straddle of a bald-faced thunderbolt. And the thin-skinned generation of that dim and distant day sure will stare with admiration when they hear old Boastful say, I was first, as old raw hiders all confessed. I'm the last of all rough riders, and the best. Huh, you soft and dainty floaters, watch your aeroplanes and motors. Huh, are you the great-grandchildren of the West? To bundle the cowboy's humor into one legendary character such as Pecos Bill is to report him falsely. The type of yarn where a super cowboy does super deeds is a weak sister to the versatile, hair-on-its-chest humor of the range. In the first place, the cowboy was much too individualistic to accept a standard figure for his humor. And secondly, his imagination far surpassed any such single creation. Thirdly, range humor, which by no means limited itself to the tall tale form, grew mostly out of real, everyday happenings. Even the most fantastic tall story was based on some elemental fact of cowboy life. The cowboy's humor is extremely revealing of him, for it reflects his pastimes, his pleasures, his complaints, his reactions to the circus of creation that even in its tragic moments seemed to hold some amusement for him. The cowboy may have realized instinctively that he was a mammal soon to lose out in the upheavals of social order. Songs such as The Cowboy's Lament reflect that he sensed the fate which awaited his breed, yet there was in him such supreme devotion and pride for his way of life that he would have chosen no other trail to ride. Someone once described the cowboy as a, quote, man with guts and a hoss, end quote. But whoever said it didn't do the cowboy justice. To describe the cowboy truthfully, the definition would be more apt to read, a man with guts and a hoss and a heck of a sense of humor. This last best marks him for what he was. Without his humor, it's doubtful that the cowboy could have survived, for his knack for seeing the humorous side of life was every bit as vital to him as his rope, horse, or six-gun. Without the ability to laugh at troubles and hard times, the cowboy could never have withstood the pressures piled on him in a world of strenuous work and violent action. It was typical of a cowboy who had been put afoot by a rabbit-shy cayuse to respond by shaking his fist after the animal and declaring, "Just for that, I'm gonna walk home." And when the waddy trudged, by the way, the author uses the term waddy, which means cowboy, frequently. I had never come across it. Anyway, and when the waddy trudged, footsore and weary, back into ranch headquarters, he would likely be asked what in the heck he meant by making that poor animal come home all by itself. The man who felt sorry for himself out west was lost. Moreover, a healthy sense of humor was often the best solution to many range problems. While on roundup once, the foreman of an outfit found that his crew was blessed with a chronic grumbler. This particular waddy never liked the camping place the cook had chosen, nor the food he fixed, and was constantly complaining about one thing or another. Wanting to keep harmony, the foreman took this in silence for some time, but finally he could stand it no longer. One day the cowboy came to him with a complaint about the food, and the foreman told him that there was nothing wrong with the food, that what he needed was some liver regulator. He suggested that the cook might be able to supply him with some of the medicine, which was kept in the grub box. Others of the crew took up his suggestion and urged the cowboy to try some of the cook's remedy. Finally, after complaining his way through a meal, the grumbler walked up to the cookie and said, "Say, how about some of that liver regulator they've been telling me about? I hope it's better than the meals we've been getting." The cook looked him over. "It sure is," he agreed, and reached into the chuck box. His hand came out of that grub box with a cocked 45 in it. "This is the best darn liver regulator I know about," the cookie said. "And if I hear one more word out of you, I'm going to let you have a big dose of it." The improvement in the waddy's health was remarkable. On another occasion, There was a big, overgrown cowpoke named Tall Cotton, whose specialty was going to sleep during duty hours, leaving the rest of the crew to do his share of the work. The boys took it for a time, but they finally decided that something had to be done about the matter. Then came the day they found Cotton, curled up in a haystack, boots off, sound asleep. The opportunity was golden. The boys rounded up a huge tarantula, killed it, and laid it close to Cotton's leg. Then they tied a pin on the end of a stick and jabbed the sleeping waddy a couple of times. Cotton came awake like a wild Comanche doing the snake dance, and, at the same time, a cowboy rushed up and smashed the tarantula with his boot heel. Cotton took one look at the dead tarantula and turned white. He began to get sick, even though the other waddies did their best to console him with stories of the horrible deaths they had seen as a result of tarantula bites. Finally, one of the crew, who'd laid claim to having read 10,000 Things Worth Knowing, as well as Dr. Chase's recipe book, offered to try to save Cotton, even though he admitted it seemed hopeless. First, the cowboy poured a pint of bear's oil down Cotton. When that started some of the poison coming out of him, they followed it up with a glass of soda, a cup of vinegar, and finally, a quart of water in which a plug of tobacco had been soaking. For a while, it seemed almost certain that Cotton was going to die from that tarantula bite. But the medicine was potent, and eventually, he was saved. After that, the crew had very little trouble with him lying down on the job, especially in haystacks. The ability to laugh off a serious matter saved as many cowboy hides as the six-gun ever did. There was, for instance, the trail herder who hit town and refused to take his run at standing guard on the herd. The trail boss went after him and found the cowboy with a rip-snorting drunk in progress. When the boss demanded that the cowboy return to the herd, the other announced that he wouldn't stand guard that night for any man, including General Grant. The trail boss saw that argument was going to accomplish little, so he knocked the cowboy down. Whereupon, the man got up. Whereupon, the boss knocked him down again. After hitting the ground for the third time, the waddy shook his head and looked up at the trail boss, who towered over him. "Boss," he asked with a sheepish grin, "just which way did you say that old herd was?" Humor was even more vital to the cow country as a source of entertainment and relaxation. After long hours in the saddle, cowboys had to have some sort of release from the strain and fatigue. Tall tale sessions, joking, pranking, and storytelling were often the results. Now the author quotes a long version of such a tale. "I reckon we'll have to try Slim Watkins this afternoon for unbecoming misdemeanors," drawled the wagon boss. Slim was gone, and therefore oblivious of the situation that faced him. "For what will you arrest him?" asked the cook. "Oh, say, for branding a maverick, for that red-headed female in Trinidad. He'll be hard to catch if he knows." "Aw, no, he won't. I'll get him when he comes in." Spring roundup of 1887, camped on the Ute Creek, northeast New Mexico. Cowboys lying over must have diversion, and one of the never-tiring amusements such situations provided is a mock trial. The sentences imposed by the court are various and as severe as the judge can invent. "We'll be lots of wild plums here this summer," Slim remarks as he got off his horse. "That is, if the hail don't kill 'em." "We'll be gone by beef hunt time," argued an innocent bystander. The cowboys eat, and after supper, Slim is grabbed. "Slim," said the functionary, "you're going to trial." A sheriff and two attorneys are delegated to their respective tasks. Denied a jury, the accused stands before the judge, who sits on a wagon tongue and whittles. "Proceed with this year case." The attorney for the prosecution was the first to speak. "This puncher, what you're all knows, is Slim Watkins. He's sure ornery, which you're likewise knows of. He'd turn a day herd loose if he dared, and beats his horse over the head with his quirt. He's before yer as having branded a big yearling calf for a girl named M, which lives in Trinidad, and is red-headed and plain. Any evidence? Inquired the judge. Reckon so. You knows yer, don't yer? I mean as ter the brandin, said the court, as all laughed at his expense. The trial proceeds and witnesses testify. One claims he caught Slim in the act of placing a brand on a white-faced calf that the animal was hog-tied. A fire of bullchips had been built on the prairie, and that the prisoner was marking the calf E.M. on the left side, and Swaller forked both ears, which he said was for M. Other character witnesses testified Slim had beaten a widder out of a washbill, stolen a new rope from a tenderfoot, and put a dead rattlesnake in the range manager's bed. The attorney for the defense claimed in rebuttal, "This year is a frame-up." But Slim was adjudged guilty and, considering the unusual orneriness of the offense, to be thrown into the water hole near camp in his clothes, hat, spurs, and boots. He was to be closely watched, and no attempt made to rescue him if he sank. On reaching shore, he was to be stripped of his pants, laid over the wagon tongue to receive a dozen lashes, put on hard with a pair of chaps, and the first day of the roundup to go on day herd. The sentence was executed in good faith, except the day herding. Slim was too old and valuable a hand for work of this sort, and that part of the court order was never enforced. By the way, that story was from Albert W. Thompson's book, They Were Open Range Days, Annals of the Western Frontier. Often, in a session around the campfire or in the bunkhouse, cowboys would take turns at storytelling. The waddy without an amusing yarn to spin was a rarity, for it was the favorite pastime among range men. Generally, the storytelling followed one of three patterns: the circular story, the tall tale, or the amusing anecdote. The circular story was usually practiced by one of the older hands who had years of chin-flapping experience, for it required a storyteller to hold his audience in suspense for as long as possible. The gist of the circular story is that the speaker begins with some particular place of action and talks in a circle until he eventually arrives back at the initial starting point and begins all over again. He will keep this up in all seriousness until the last listener has finally caught on. But sometimes the goat of the joke, if he were a stranger to the storyteller, would turn the tables by handing a joker a note stating that he was deaf and would appreciate the other telling his story over again, this time speaking louder. Typical of the tall tale telling is the one the cowboy spun about a gun he once owned which shot so hard it would have been against the law to fire it off in a civilized country. Once the gun went off accidentally, and, in the interest of humanity, the cowboy followed the bullet. He'd not gone far when he found a dead deer. Then, shortly, he came to where the lead had struck a tree limb, splitting it and catching the toes of a dozen turkey gobblers which had been roosting there. The bullet had then broken open a bee tree from which the cowboy had procured over 100 pounds of wild honey. He admitted that, since you can't tell a bee tree by looking at it, this last was pure luck. This, in turn, might remind a fellow puncher of a gun he had once seen, the biggest buffalo gun ever to hit the plains. It was so big that it didn't have a caliber, and if it had been a shotgun, it would not have had a gauge. While on the plains one day, the cowboy had fired it at a buffalo bull. The bull fell as if dead, but when it was about half-skinned, it came to life and took out after the waddy. The cowboy knew he couldn't run fast enough to escape, and there wasn't a place in sight where he could take cover. Then, just when it looked for certain that he was doomed, he suddenly realized that he had just one hope. Throwing down the buffalo gun, he ran up the barrel and let the bull go on past. The cowboy by no means invented the tall tale, but he proved that he had the capacity to dream up some good ones. Jack Thorpe, respected and well-liked New Mexico rancher, loved to recite the tall story of Old Man Yost and his herd of dry land terrapins. Old Man Yost was eating in a fancy San Antonio restaurant one day when he realized the soup he was having was turtle soup and that it cost 6 bits a dish in Texas. Up north, it would sell for about $2. The cowman, having just gone broke in the cattle business after some trouble with his partner, thought of all the dry land terrapins running around loose on the Texas prairie, multiplied that by $2 a head, and came up with the total of $359,664, and the ambitions to be the first man ever to drive a turtle herd north. He rode back to his ranch and started gathering his herd. He sent his punchers out with gunny sacks tied to their saddle horns, and it wasn't long before they corralled exactly 14,986 turtle. The old man was chomping at the bit to be off, so they hit the trail with the herd. From experience gained in rounding up the herd, Yost knew that he would have to keep the turtles on high ground, for if they struck a sandy flat, they would likely stampede, attempting to dig themselves in. The cowboys discovered right away the uselessness of trying to throw their ropes, for the turtles would only duck back into their shells and dodge the loops. The first day they made a quarter of a mile's progress. After some more quick mathematics, the old man saw that in only 5,600 days he would have his herd to market. But he also thought of the fortune he would make and pushed on. The months passed, and when late fall came, the herd was so restless that it could hardly be held on the bed ground. The cowboys tried laying the turtles on their backs at night, but they found that the critters kicked their legs so much that they were too tired to travel the next day. And, after one cold night, they had to leave behind several hundred head because of frostbitten feet. Finally, the herd reached the Red River. Yost was not worrying about crossing, for they had crossed other rivers without a single loss. But he didn't know that his former partner had heard about the terrapin herd and was jealously scheming to stop it. As the herd pushed into the river, Yost noticed someone in a boat rowing out to place an object on a log in the middle of the stream. He didn't think anything about the matter, but when his turtle herd reached the log, every last one of them suddenly dove to the bottom of the river. Old Man Yost later figured that right then and there he lost somewhere around $500,000, and all because his old partner was mean enough to put a diving mud turtle in front of his dry land terrapin herd. Even the cowboy's ordinary speech was rich with humor. He was, in fact, a master at amusing, picturesque phraseology, which employed similes and metaphors drawn from range life. Ramon F. Adams, an expert on the subject of Western speech, claims that listening to a group of cowboys talk about themselves is better than any vaudeville show. In his book, Cowboy Lingo, he illustrates the cowboy's ability to paint word pictures with a paragraph from a letter by Charlie Russell. Pat Riley was killed while sleeping off a drunk at Grass Range. Pat took a booze joint and, after smoking the place up and running everybody out till it looked like it was for rent, fell asleep. The booze boss gets a gun and comes back and catches Pat slumbering. Pat never woke up, but he did quit snoring. At times the cowboy was capable of some good wit. A story is told of a cowboy who was invited by an English duke to have a drink with him in Dodge City. Naturally, the invitation was accepted. Thus, the two men, one schooled in the age-old traditions of England, and the other, a product of the American plains, bent elbows together. In paying for the drinks, the Englishman reached into his pocket and came out with a coin. Reminded by it of his heritage, the Duke held the coin before the cowboy. "You see the likeness of His Majesty, the King, on this coin? He made my grandfather a lord." The cowboy looked the coin over solemnly, then dug into the pockets of his breeches and came out with a copper penny. "Uh-huh," he said, and see the likeness of that red engine on this here penny? He made an angel out of my grandpappy. Cow country humor was more than mere storytelling. It was an ingrained reaction, an esprit de corps, a philosophy common to the just plain bow-legged humans of the range. Without a doubt, the cowboy excelled any other vocational group when it came to integrating a sense of humor into everyday affairs. For him, there was little too serious or too sacred to have its humorous side. That concludes Laugh Kills Lonesome. Now we will read Law Without Order. And our author starts with a quote from a tombstone in Boot Hill, Dodge City, Kansas. "Shoot 'em up, Joe. Run for Sheriff 1872. Run from Sheriff 1876. Buried 1876. To the cow country, law and order was a rather loose term. It could mean anything from a decision by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to the personal opinions of some grim-mouthed gentlemen who were calmly tossing a lariat over the limb of a cottonwood tree. Most Westerners liked the law well enough, but weren't sure it ought to be out west, and the respect that many had for it varied proportionately with the quickness of the sheriff's gun hand. All in all, the range felt that it had a pretty good set of rules of its own and resented outside interference. In fact, in some sections, the name Son of a Gun Stew was changed to District Attorney Stew. The indifference to formal law was reflected in the courts of law of the West. On one occasion, two attorneys had heatedly continued their argument after the jury had withdrawn. When accused of misreading a point of law, one attorney lost his temper and called the other a dirty, lying dog. His opposition countered with a like estimation. The courtroom quieted in anticipation of hearing the judge assess fines upon the lawyers. However, he spoke calmly. "I'm happy that you two gentlemen are acquainted with each other. May we proceed with the case now?" In another court, a certain lawyer who is noted for his oratorical abilities undertook to discuss at great length a point not entirely relevant to the case. As he was about to reach the emotional peak of his delivery, a jackass suddenly began singing outside the courthouse window. The attorney for the opposition came to his feet. "If the court pleases," he announced gravely, "I would like to second the opinion of the attorney on the outside." During early Fort Smith, Arkansas days, a horse thief was brought before Judge Isaac C. Parker. The man was given a severe tongue-lashing and fined $200. Upon hearing the fine, the horse thief thought he was going to get off lightly and jerked a big roll of bills from his pocket. He began to peel off 20s. "And 20 years in prison," Parker added. "See if you can pull that out of your pocket." Another young citizen of the West was arrested for horse thievery and brought to trial. The evidence was overwhelmingly against him, but his lawyer went around the facts of the case, concentrating on the more emotional values in the accused widowed mother, wife, and children. As a final touch, he called upon the jury to gaze into the face of the defendant to see if they could find the look of a guilty man. They evidently did not, for they retired and came back with a quick, not guilty verdict. After the trial, a friend of the young man came up to him and asked confidentially, "Did you really steal that hoss or not?" "Well," the cowboy said, scratching his head, "I really can't say. I thought I did, but after hearing that there lawyer's speech, darned if I'm so sure." Most infamous of all Western courts was that of Judge Roy Bean of Langtree, Texas. Roy was known to be much less interested in justice than in the jingling pockets of whoever might be so unfortunate as to stand accused before him. One of his most recounted decisions concerned the occasion when the body of a dead man was found near Langtree. On the corpse was a 6-shooter and $40, but no identification. Judge Bean stuck the 6-shooter in his belt and the $40 in his pocket. When someone asked by what authority he thought he could take the money, he replied that he had tried the man and fined him for carrying a concealed weapon. Sometimes, out west, it didn't do a bit of good to be dead. This opinion was reversed, however, when a friend of Bean's was brought to court on charges of carrying a concealed weapon. He said that if his friend had been standing still when arrested, then he was obviously not carrying a weapon. And if he was moving, then he was traveling. And travelers had a legal right to carry weapons. One trial in Judge Bean's court involved a young, eager lawyer who continually objected to Bean's rulings and judicial opinions. Bean overruled him in every case. But when the lawyer threatened to habeas corpus his client, the judge angrily threatened to hang the lawyer if the man did not use more respectful language in the courtroom. The case was dropped for lack of a prosecuting attorney. A notable murder trial was underway in an Oklahoma territorial court, and one of the lawyers, a heavy drinker, went to sleep during a noon recess. When the trial got underway again, the lawyer continued to sleep and could not be awakened. The judge cast a glance at the man, then asked, "Gentlemen of the bar, what shall we do with him?" The opposing counsel rose. "I move the court order him poured back into the bottle." "So ordered." Cattle auctioneers are quite often known under the honorary title of colonel, and one was once called on to testify in court. The prosecuting attorney worked very hard to knock a dent in the colonel's testimony, but did not succeed. Angry at his failure, the lawyer took up the weapon of sarcasm. "You call yourself a colonel," he said. "Now, just what were you a colonel in?" "Well," the other returned without hesitation, "I reckon you'd call it the cow brigade." The lawyer gave one of his most potent sneers. "Then, you're really not a colonel at all?" "No," the auctioneer replied calmly. "It's just like that honorable in front of your name. It don't mean a thing." One of the best sure thing men that ever hit the town of Dodge City was Mr. Bobby Gill. Once, when he was broke, Bobby was arrested for some minor offense and brought before the police court. He was fined $20 in costs. Now, Bobby was no small timer, and around Dodge City he had gained certain recognition. The marshal felt sorry for his having to face such a small fine and offered to throw off his part of the costs. The clerk agreed to do the same, and the judge said, "So will I. Now, Mr. Gill, you have anything to say for yourself?" Bobby rose promptly. "Your Honor," he said, "I've never yet been outdone in generosity, and I won't be now. I will throw off the fine." Big Mike, Irish of course, was being tried on a serious charge, yet he refused counsel, saying that he would defend himself. As the trial progressed, Mike, who knew nothing about legal procedure, made a continual bother of himself by interrupting testimonies and yelling at the prosecuting attorney. Finally, the judge told Mike in plain language to sit down and shut up, adding, "You'll get justice in this court."
"Begorra," cried Mike, "that's what I'm afraid of."
In Tombstone, Walter Noble Burns tells the story of S. C. Bagg, editor of the Prospector, who criticized in his paper a decision rendered by Judge W. H. Barnes of the District Court and was fined $500 for contempt. Bagg had money enough, but, as a matter of principle, he refused to pay the fine. Barnes ordered him committed to jail, where Bagg remained for several weeks, editing his paper from his cell and enjoying immensely his martyrdom. He even refused to accept the help of his friends, and finally the sheriff had to throw him out and lock the jail doors after him. Several years later, Judge Barnes, then retired from the bench, was sent to jail for contempt by Judge R. E. Sloan. As he passed through the prison doors, he was on the verge of collapse and was sustained only by the sympathy of his friends. His spirits were lifted when a messenger arrived with a telegram.
"Friends from afar have heard of this damnable outrage," he declared,
and ripped open the envelope.
"Are you there, Moriarty?"
it read. It was signed by S.C. Begg. One prisoner brought before Judge Parker was a slim-faced, balding man with beady eyes. He was charged with bigamy.
"Your name?" asked the judge.
"Lee Galcatcher."
Parker looked over his glasses at the man, then turned to the bailiff.
"Take him back. This man couldn't be guilty of bigamy. He never caught a gal in his life."
On another occasion, in Parker's court, a witness for the prosecution was testifying as to the character of the complainant. The defense attorney was seeking to lay the predicate for impeaching the witness's testimony.
"You will admit, won't you," asked the attorney,
"that the complainant has a good deal of trouble with his neighbors, that he quarrels often, and has had several fights recently?"
"Yes," admitted the witness, "I know that."
"And you know, too, that he gets drunk, beats up his wife, and that, last spring, he nearly whipped his young son to death? And you are aware that this man is arrested for being drunk nearly every time he comes to town, that he spends most of his time in jail?"
"Sure," agreed the character witness. "I know all those things."
"What?" cried the lawyer. "You admit knowing all about this man, and yet you swear that his reputation is good in your community?"
"Yes," returned the man earnestly. "It takes a lot more than that to get a bad reputation where I come from."
Irishman Justice Joyce presided over the Hays City, Kansas court with an iron hand. One day, an Irishman was brought to court for having killed a fellow railroad section hand with a shovel in an argument. There'd been no one present to witness the affair, and it seemed the court would have to take the word of the prisoner as to what happened. When it came time to plead, the accused was asked, "Guilty or not guilty?"
"Guilty, Your Honor."
Justice Joyce leaned over the bench and glowered at his fellow Irishman.
"Shut up," he rasped. "I discharge you for want of evidence."
The courts thus reflected the attitude of the range country toward written law. Inevitably, a cowboy or a rancher would choose to settle his difficulties outside the courtroom according to the custom of cow country society. Most cowboys felt as did the old-timer, who was telling a younger hand of the days when horse thieves were hanged first and tried afterwards.
"We never did hang the wrong one but once or twice," he said, "and them fellers needed to be hung anyway, just on general principles."
The rangeland had strict ideas on the matter of stealing, particularly of horses and cattle, yet it could not deny the fact that some of the largest and most respected brands to grow up in the West were ones of dubious beginnings. Cowboys liked to tell of the tenderfoot who arrived in the West with nothing more than one lone steer and a branding iron, and ended up with a herd of fine cattle. Undeniably, it was a capable steer, yet no more so than the cows of a rancher which invariably produced twins and frequently triplets, while the calfless cows of the other neighboring ranches persisted in hanging around this man's corral and bawling. The other ranchers finally had to threaten to hang the man if his cows continued to produce more than one calf at a time. One cowboy said, in speaking of another whose calves sometimes bore rather vague brands,
"Old Bill is the most kind-hearted soul you ever saw. He just can't stand to see a dogie wandering around without a mark on it. He's always giving one a brand with his own iron."
Cattlemen were not entirely unreasonable about the matter. They could accept an occasional loss of a calf to a hungry nester or a wayfaring cowboy. One old cowman rode up one day to the chuck wagon of an outfit which was enjoying choice steaks from a freshly killed calf. The hide, wearing the cowman's brand, was hanging in plain sight. The foreman of the outfit invited the cattleman to light and join them. The rancher did, but could not resist the mild comment that every outfit ought to eat its own beef. The foreman nodded in agreement.
I reckon that's so, he said. But for some reason, your beef always seems to taste a little better than ours. You want to try some?
And the rancher joined the grinning crew and helped them finish off the meat, which he had unintentionally furnished. Another time, on joint roundup, a cowboy spied a calf with another brand sucking one of his cows. Obviously, the calf had been misbranded. With cow country diplomacy, the rancher rode over to the foreman of the other brand and engaged him in conversation.
I seen a funny thing well ago, he said at length. One of your calves is following one of my cows around and bawling and talking to her. It says, Mama, Mama, them old LFD boys just chased me around and roped me and dragged me and slapped that big LFD on my shoulder. And I wanted a nice little you like you have, Mama.
The rancher let this soak in, then went on.
I felt plumb sorry for the little critter, and I reckon he's right. Another one of them big LFDs would spoil the poor thing's hide, and I don't reckon any of your boys would want to do that to him, would they?
Cowboys had a lot of fun with brands. They often spent their spare moments tracing patterns and figures for brands in the sand, figuring out new ones or ways to alter old ones. Some of the cowboys did it for fun, and some tried to make a business out of it. The story goes that a rancher whose brand was IC found that a rustler had been working it over to read ICU. But the rancher went him one better. He held a roundup and rebranded. This time his brand read ICU2. A similar yarn tells of a man who moved into a new country which was infested with thieves. His brand was B4. The thieves changed it to B4U, but the rancher got in the final word with the mark, B4U2. Horse stealing was a more serious matter, generally, than the rustling of cattle, for the simple reason that horses were more vital to the livelihood in the West, especially for the cowboy. It was not entirely a matter of affection for him, for a cowboy afoot was a cowboy in a fix. Because of this, horse stealing was often an offense of serious consequences, whereas mere cow stealing could, in many cases, be taken tongue-in-cheek. Yet, even horse thievery was not beyond the range of cowboy humor. For instance, there was the cowboy who rode into Tombstone on an eye-catching mount and put him up at a livery stable. A local citizen happened to see the horse and offered the stranger a good price for him. The man accepted the offer, and the transaction was made. When asked if the title on the horse was good, the cowboy looked up from counting his money and nodded.
Well, it's good enough just so long as you go west. But I wouldn't take that hoss east if I were you. The title ain't so good in that direction.
In Texas, a cowboy pleaded not guilty on a horse-stealing count, and, because his lawyer gave him able defense, he was adjudged to be innocent by the jury. The judge told the cowboy that he was a free man. The cowboy started to leave the courtroom, then turned back to the judge with a puzzled look.
Judge, he asked, does this mean I can keep the hoss?
And you just can't get much more innocent than the cowboy in the verses of On the Dodge. Last week, I found a stake pin I had lost. Just an iron one. About a dollar it had cost. On it was tied a rope, and it almost got my goat when I found the other end tied to a horse. I'm as innocent as any man can be, but I'm afraid the judge will not agree. As there isn't any use in dishing up a poor excuse, I might as well just saddle up and flee. Another horse thief had been arrested, tried, and after much debate, was found to be innocent by a jury. The jury filed back into the courtroom, and the foreman made his speech. It took him over an hour to tell, in fancy oratory, that the defendant had been found innocent of all charges. But the judge shook his head.
You'll have to reconsider, he said. The defendant was hung a couple of hours ago.
From New Mexico comes the story of a rancher who returned home to find several head of his fine horses missing. The rancher immediately saddled up and rode off. Several days later, he returned to the ranch with all his horses, and he had nothing to say about their disappearance until someone finally asked him what had happened to the thief.
"Well, it's like this," he explained. "I followed the tracks for 2 days, and late in the evening of the second, I came onto this hombre driving my horses. I caught him and put him with his hands tied on one of the hosses and headed back. Night came, we had to make camp. In order to keep this feller from leaving, I left him on the hoss, tied a rope round his neck, and hitched the other end to a tree limb. I figured this would keep him in place, so I went to sleep. But you know, the next morning I woke up, and there that hombre was, dangling from that limb. You know, I'd plumb forgot to stake that horse to keep it from grazing off during the night."
A cowboy with a shady reputation asked a cattleman for a job. The rancher was skeptical, but agreed to give the man a chance to show what he could do. That evening, at the corral, he told the cowboy to rope a certain horse. The waddy tried several loops and missed them all. He tried to use darkness as an excuse.
"Darkness, heck!" exploded the disgusted rancher. "Your trouble is that all your roping experience has been at night instead of in the daytime."
While visiting a sheep camp, two cowboys noticed some Navajo blankets and, on the grounds that sheepmen aren't human, decided to steal and sell them. Rather than take the blankets back to camp, the waddies cached them by burying them in the ground. It was agreed that they would return together later, get the loot, and take it to town to sell it. But one cowboy got to thinking about the matter and decided that it would be better to have all rather than half the amount for which they could sell the blankets. But when he returned to where they had hidden them, he found an empty hole in the ground and a note from his buddy. "I got to thinking, Charlie, it ain't right to steal. You done wrong to take them blankets, so I'm taking them all so yous won't have no stolen goods and your conscience won't worry you none." The business of law enforcement also had its lighter moments. A cowboy who had killed a real estate salesman in a gun duel reported the incident to the sheriff and offered to give himself up. He asked the law officer what he would get for committing such a crime.
"Shucks," snorted the lawman, "you won't get nothing. We took the bounty off them fellers a long time ago."
Sheriff Elfego Baca of New Mexico once sent a deputy out to get a certain bad hombre who had broken jail. The deputy was gone for nearly a week before Sheriff Baca received from him a very lengthy telegram which told in detail of the capture of the bad man and of the deputy's heroic efforts in achieving same. It ended by asking Baca, "What do I do with him now?" The deputy received his answer in exactly 10 words.
"Kiss him twice and bring him in, you darn fool."
And that concludes Stan Hoig's story, Law Without Order. Because this is the first time we've encountered Stan Hoig, I wanted to read you a little bit about him. This is from a proclamation when Stanley W. Hoig was inducted into the Oklahoma Higher Education Hall of Fame. Oklahoma has produced many notable writers and historians, and standing proudly among the best of them is Stanley W. Hoig. Stan Hoig earned his B.A. in 1949 as an English major and a history minor at Oklahoma State University. He went on to the University of Oklahoma, where he earned his M.A. in 1964 in journalism with a history minor and his Ph.D. in 1971 in higher education and history. He was employed by the University of Central Oklahoma in 1964, who was then called Central State College, as a journalism professor. He regaled his students with stories of Oklahoma and inspired them to be writers, and thus became one of the campus's most popular lecturers. Born in Duncan, Oklahoma, and raised in Gage, Professor Hoig loved the state's history and wrote about it until his death in 2009. And right he did. He published 23 books on Oklahoma's Western heritage, and particularly about its Native American ancestry. He contributed to a host of encyclopedias on Western, Native American, and Oklahoma history, and produced 4 local histories, primarily about Edmond and Central State. He served as an advisor to television shows on Native American and Oklahoma history. Through his extensive publications, Stanley Hoyt earned numerous writing awards. Among them are the Clement E. Trout Writing Award from Oklahoma State University, the U.S. Treasury Department Award, 2 Muriel H. Wright Awards from the Oklahoma Historical Society, a Distinguished Scholar Award from the American Association of University Professors, the Ralph Ellison Lifetime Achievement Award from the Oklahoma Center for the Book, and the Myers Center Award for his book, Trail of Tears, for outstanding work on intolerance. Other Hall of Fame accolades received by Dr. Hoyt include the Edmond Award in 1990, the Oklahoma Journalism Award in 1994, and the Oklahoma Historians Award in 1997. For his outstanding work in the classroom, and for his exemplary and prestigious career chronicling the history of Native Americans and Oklahomans, the Oklahoma Higher Education Society is honored to induct Stanley W. Hoyt into the Oklahoma Higher Education Hall of Fame. And that's all we have today from The Humor of the American Cowboy by Stan Hoyt. I want to thank you for joining us for Western Short Stories. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, up flown through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.